The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grounded, supported, and ready to grow. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Whether it's your first time in therapy or your 50th, Grow makes it easier to find a therapist who fits you, not the other way around. They connect you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions nights and weekends. You can search by what matters, like insurance, specialty, identity, or availability to get started in as little as 2 days. And if something comes up, you can cancel up to 24 hours in advance at no cost. There are no subscriptions and no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow helps you find therapy on your time. Whatever challenges you're facing, Grow Therapy is here to help. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid, in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/get started today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/get started. growtherapy.com/get started. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Always trust your gut. Stay in the Illinois. Hello, Resi Crew. My name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. On Residue, we explore the truth behind your favorite movies, and today we are talking about the film Alpha Dog, the true story of Nicholas Markowitz. And as you know, Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, produced by me, your lovely host, or as one tiny little man from YouTube said, your ridiculous host, Chrissy. Hi, guys. I love you. Thank you so much for being here. And as you know, you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, TikTok, Residue A True Crime Podcast, Facebook, Residue A True Crime Podcast. My Facebook is tanking. Like, I don't even go there anymore. So I'm sorry if you are one of the 288 people that are following me on Facebook, but I feel like I'm just kind of lost over there. I feel like TikTok is where it's at for me, and I'm really trying to get the Instagram up. So if you guys wouldn't mind jumping on over to Instagram and, you know, following me, that would be so great. But while we're on the topic too, I really hate saying followers because it makes me feel like a cult leader. It's like, I have this many followers on TikTok. And last but not least, you know that the greatest thing you can do for any indie podcaster that you love is to leave a positive review. That just helps get the show pushed out more. It helps us realize that all of this hard work that we're putting into this is really being recognized. And it also makes us feel pretty amazing. So I just love you guys so much, and I want to give you one more thank you for all of the positive reviews that you have left. You guys rule. As always, a listener discretion is advised. This is a really rough story. I know that this movie really wrecked a lot of hearts out there when they first saw this film. It has a horrific ending. And the main source I used for today's episode isn't the movie Alpha Dog. It's going to be the book called My Stolen Son, The Nick Markowitz Story. And this is written by Nick's mother, Susan, with the help of Jenna Glatzer.
Thank you.
Alpha Dog is a 2006 crime drama directed by Nick Cassavetes. And although some of the names and some details were changed for the film, this film is based on the real-life murder of Nick Markowitz. The cast is Emile Hirsch as Johnny Truelove, based on Jesse James Hollywood, Justin Timberlake as Frankie Bollenbacker, based on Jesse Ruge, and we have Anton Yelchin as Zach Mazursky, and this is based on Nick Markowitz. We also have Ben Foster, Sean Hatosi, Amanda Seyfried, Sharon Stone, and Bruce Willis. The cast was notable because many actors were young and they were at the start of their major careers. Now, this movie follows Johnny Truelove, a young drug dealer who prides himself on control, loyalty, and reputation. When a drug deal goes wrong and Johnny believes he's owed money, he makes a reckless decision to use his debtor's younger brother as leverage. And at first, the situation feels casual and the boy is treated more like a guest than a hostage. But as time passes, paranoia sets in and Johnny becomes increasingly afraid of consequences and of losing his image as someone who cannot be crossed. Rather than resolving the situation responsibly, Johnny peer pressures others to carry out his worst decision. And the story shows how fear, immaturity, and the need to impress spiral into irreversible tragedy. Susan and Jeff Markowitz, Nicholas's parents, they were completely against this movie. They did not want Alpha Dog to be made. And Jeff elaborated on this by saying that Susan is so tortured by what happened that she has tried to take her own life. The last thing that either of us want to see is this picture. How would any loving parent feel about a Hollywood movie that glamorizes their son's death and allows celebrities to cash in on a brutal, evil murder? Initially against the film, the parents of Nick attended the film's premiere, and Nick's mother, Susan, actually said that she was really moved by Anton Yelchin's portrayal of Nick. And after the screening, Susan embraced Sharon Stone, who played Olivia, who was in fact Susan Markowitz. So while inspired by real events, the film changed names, it combined characters, it added dramatic dialogue and scenes, and it focused heavily on the perpetrator's social world. And that was very highly criticized by Nick's mother, Susan, who felt that the movie gave too much attention to the people responsible and not enough attention to Nick as a person. And that criticism is part of why Susan later wrote My Stolen Son, to center her child, not the criminals. Alpha Dog is described as a glossy yet unflinching portrait of violent, hedonistic teenagers. Bruce Willis and Sharon Stone chew the scenery while Justin Timberlake gives a noteworthy performance. A Letterboxd review of Alpha Dog states, "This movie sucks you in, seduces you, entrances you, and then whacks you over the head with a baseball bat." Susan Markowitz begins My Stolen Son, the Nick Markowitz story, not with violence or loss, but with longing. Long before tragedy entered Susan's life, her deepest wish was to become a mother. And she frames this desire as central to her identity, a dream that shaped her choices and her understanding of her family. In the book's early pages, she recounts meeting Nick's father, Jeff, during a casual night out at a bar. This bar used to have this night called Screw Night, and you would all be given a different type of screw, and then I guess you would have to walk around the bar and find the person whose nut fit into the screw. But you had to fit your screws together somehow. And these two ended up having a conversation, Jeff and Susan, Nick's parents, and what might have seemed insignificant at the time later becomes, in Susan's reflection, the starting point of a life forever altered. By opening her narrative this way, Susan emphasizes how ordinary and hopeful her beginnings were. In this book, Susan reflects on the decisions that she made while raising her children. So when Susan met Jeff, he was divorced with two children named Leah and Ben. Then on September 19th, 1984, they welcomed a baby boy that they named Nicholas Samuel Markowitz. One of the most important decisions that Susan reflects on as a parent is the fact that her and Jeff decided to take Leah and Ben out of private school. And she mentions that this decision could have been the very beginning of the tragedy. And she notes that if they would have just left Ben in this private school, that maybe he wouldn't have met the friends that he did meet and he wouldn't have become the person that he became. And most of Susan's book centers on this idea of a mother's perspective, that it's defined by love, by memories, and her ongoing search for meaning after this unimaginable loss. And Susan will reflect on the ways that she tried to mother her stepson, Ben, and the ways that she tried to get through to him, tried to connect with him. And one of those ways was giving him a journal. But not just a journal that he could write in, it was one that they could share. So Susan would write Ben a letter, you know, telling him how proud she was of him or just how thankful she was to have him in her life, and Ben would write back to her. And this, again, was Susan's way of trying to connect with Ben and Leah, because Ben and Leah's mom, Jeff's ex, she was not the most understanding ex-wife. She did not like the fact that Jeff had this new wife and that this new woman was in her children's life, and she was causing a lot of chaos. There was a lot of friction at all times. So Susan thought this would be a nice, comforting, and quiet way to communicate with the kids and let them know that she is here for them. She is a person in their life that they can always trust and always count on. And the thing is that Leah wasn't that much of a problem for Susan. It was Ben. Ben started acting out, and Ben became a pretty rough time for the family. Ben's already getting in trouble at about 12 years old. When he was 12 years old, he asked his dad, "Hey, can you drive me to the movie theater?" His dad's like, "Sure." Ben says, "My friend's mom's gonna drop us off at home when the movie's over." So Jeff says, "Okay," but Jeff goes home, calls the friend's mom and says, "So you're picking the kids up after the movie, right?" And this mom is like, "What are you talking about? I know nothing of a movie theater pickup." And all hell breaks loose. They are looking everywhere for 12-year-old Ben. They even drive back to the movie theater, go up and down the aisles. No Ben. They can't find him anywhere. So some of the parents that they're calling to find out where their son is, they start talking. Their kids start talking. And all of these little pieces of these stories start coming together. So the first piece of the story is that Ben had a broken arm. He told his parents he fell off his bike, but his parents are just now finding out Ben didn't fall off of a bike. Ben was jumped and initiated into a gang by getting his ass kicked and in turn broke his arm. Now, the name of this gang was the DTS. And DTS stood for Down to Serve. So Down to Serve was this gang of younger kids, you know, preteens, teenagers, and all they liked to do was steal and sometimes break people's mailboxes with a baseball bat. But as the years are going on, these gang of DTS kids, they start stealing cars. And so one of the kids in the gang calls Ben and tells him that he's a police officer and he needs to talk to Ben and he wants to ask Ben about the car thefts. So these kids and the gang, they're basically trying to set Ben up to see if he's going to be a rat or if they can trust him. And Ben can definitely be trusted because he didn't know what to do other than just run away. He didn't want anything to do with it. He wasn't going to talk to the police. He just wasn't going to be around anymore. So he asked his father to drop him off at the movies. And that is when he just like went on the run to try to get away from this officer that wanted to question him. So you see, Ben did not want to be questioned by a police officer, and he definitely did not want to be questioned in front of his own parents. So instead, he asks his dad to drive him to the movie theater, and when his dad pulls away, Ben steals a car, and he takes off to to Palm Springs. Let me remind you, Ben is 12 years old at this point. Ben ended up getting caught. His parents knew where he was headed, and they were there waiting for him. Ben was with another boy that was 15 years old, and he was also a new member of this gang. So when they all are at this point where Ben has been caught, the police are called, Ben's mother shows up. And Susan reflects on the fact that she always thought that it was Ben's mother's fault that he acted this way. But at this point, Ben was living with Susan and Jeff. And at this point, Ben hadn't lived with his mother in over 6 months. So Susan says she's standing here being so cocky, thinking that it's all Ben's mother's fault. And in the meantime, they're the ones who had him under their watch when he committed not only car theft, but he was in possession of a gun. So this whole incident at age 12 lands Ben right in a juvenile detention center. So this is when Susan reflects on the fact that, you know, maybe they shouldn't have a sailboat. Maybe they should have sold their sailboat, used that money to keep Ben in a private institution, in a private school, so he wouldn't be hanging around these kids. Then she says, after this arrest with the stolen car, with the gun possession, he spent a little time in juvie. He came home and things seemed relatively quiet. With the family, she decided that at this point, she is going to start putting some positive reinforcement into Ben. She's going to make him remember, make him know all of the good things about himself. And this is when they enroll him in sports, and he especially takes a liking to Taekwondo. And it is also around this time that Susan buys the journal for Ben to write in. But she wrote the first note. She wrote, "Ben, you make me so proud. Your efforts are shining through. Keep up the good work. If I can help you, let me know." And Ben loved this. He was happy with this type of communication. He even wrote back, "Susan, I really like staying home, and you have been really helpful with Taekwondo and everything." He would often write little notes like, "I appreciate every little thing you do for me. Even though at the time I might not act like it, I won't let you or Dad down this time, so don't you worry about it." Or things like, "I just want to thank you for letting me do Taekwondo." I mean, Ben was really appreciating his parents at this point in life. But things just got bad again. It was like Ben couldn't stay on track, and the constant arguing about this situation between Susan and Jeff caused Susan to want to just leave with Nick. And she threatened to leave, but Jeff would always get her to stay. At this point, Nick is about 8 years old, and his older brother Ben and his older sister Leah are both going through these bouts of good times and bad times. Leah started dating an older man, and Jeff did not approve of it, and Leah got pissed. So she left the home and went and lived with her mother again. And Susan says that at that point, that was basically just it with Leah. They didn't really see her anymore. And Ben was starting high school. Susan is warning him, you know, big schools, you know, there can be big trouble there. So just be on your best behavior, because we don't want you involved with this gang scene again. And as a mother, Susan is worried for her young son Nick's safety. He's starting to look up to his older brother Ben. He's starting to act a little like him. Susan notes that she also bought Nick a journal on his 8th birthday, and Nick would sign his name just like Ben would, with a little peace sign. And Nick would write things to his mother like, "Dear Mom, next time you write back to me, please let me know what I should be for Halloween. It's really important to me that I have a cool Halloween costume." And as another example, just so you can understand how close Nick and Susan were, Nick wrote his mother this letter. "Dear Mom, I had a terrible day. I wish I was dead. Sometimes I forget my math books, and my teacher said if I and a few other kids didn't have our math done by Monday, we are in big trouble. Right now, I'm crying bad. I messed up my Lego ship. I'm really sad. I think I want you to talk about it with me in the morning. Love, Nick. Peace sign. I love you." Well, Susan saw this note right away that night, and she wrote back quickly, "Nick, how about if we don't sleep on this? First of all, I don't ever want you to wish you were dead. I don't think any of us really understands death except for it to equal gone forever. And I don't want that ever for you, as I'm sure you feel the same way for me. About the math books, you need to try to be more responsible for your homework. I'm not in class to hear or remind you of things. That is your place to be a big boy, okay? In the morning, I'll help you with Legos. Just remember, I love you so much. XOXO, Mommy. Susan Markowitz describes Jesse James Hollywood as a man of small stature with an unusual position, considering that he is 5'4" and 140 pounds. Susan compares Jesse James Hollywood to the average teenage girl. In the movie Alpha Dog, Emil Hirsch portrays Johnny Truelove, who is actually Jesse James Hollywood. Now, Susan says that Hollywood's power didn't come from his physique, so it didn't matter that he was only 5'4". This power came from his family, his father, his army of minions, and the people who owed him money. It also came from Hollywood's extensive gun collection. Jesse James Hollywood never graduated high school. He was actually suspended 1 week before graduation, but the school principal would not reveal why. Now, it is speculated that because Hollywood took all of these muscle supplements, he took steroids, he started powerlifting, he was trying to build up his muscle mass. His high school coach later described him as a, quote, emotional kid, and said that he was expelled for erupting into a violent fit of rage at one of his teachers near the end of his sophomore year. Jesse James Hollywood was born on January 28, 1980, in the West Hills neighborhood of Los Angeles. No longer a high school student, Hollywood starts his own marijuana business. He starts selling drugs and he starts getting all of his friends involved in this. They create their own little business. It's very successful. At only 19 years old, Hollywood already owned his own three-bedroom home. In the West Hills, he was driving a Cadillac, he was driving a sports car, and he had a huge gun collection. So the way this drug business worked for Hollywood, he would have all of these drugs. He would deal them out to his friends, and then his friends would have to go to the streets, sell the drugs, and bring home a specific amount of money. But if they did not bring home the right amount of money, if they came up short, they would act as if they were indentured servants to Hollywood. Hollywood loved having power over people that owed him money. So if one of his dealers would come back with the wrong amount of money, he would make them do certain things. And that was how they paid off their debt. And Hollywood had one of his friends under his absolute control. His name was Ryan Hoyt. And Susan calls Ryan Hoyt the chump of the group. And it's pretty fitting that Jesse James Hollywood also had a dog named Chump. Now, Ryan Hoyt was super close to the Hollywood family. I'm talking since childhood. At only 5 years old, Ryan's parents divorced, and his mother would always refer to Ryan as an unstable child. Now, Ryan's sister was a heroin addict, his brother was a convicted felon, and his father was abusive, so there was no support in sight for Ryan Hoyt. He latched on to the Hollywood family, so much so that he was like a younger brother to Jesse James Hollywood. Hollywood bought Ryan a car, paid for the registration, put the registration under his own name, and Ryan let all of this lapse, so he owed Jesse money. And this is what Jesse liked. Jesse liked power over people. Having people owe him money gave him power. And Ryan had no sense of self-worth. He would do anything that Hollywood told him to do, and everybody knew it. Ryan was constantly made fun of. You may recall this scene in the very beginning of the film Alpha Dog, when Justin Timberlake's character is ridiculing Sean Hatosi's character, because Sean Hatosi is playing Ryan Hoyt. And how do these two all tie into the Markowitz family? Well, that is because Ben Markowitz had fallen in with a rough crowd, and he did rack up a $1,200 debt to Jesse James Hollywood. But here's the thing, and you might remember this from the movie Alpha Dog, but Hollywood was afraid of Ben. Ben was tough. Ben is a tough dude. I mean, he's got, I believe, a black belt in Taekwondo. You might remember Ben Foster in the film doing a lot of backflips, kicking the shit out of everyone. Ben Foster played Ben Markowitz. It's crazy how scared Hollywood was of Ben Markowitz. Now, Ben has known Jesse James Hollywood since their Little League days. They lived in the same town, they were on the Little League teams together, but they were never really friends. The friendship didn't start until they were older. Ben is 2 years older than Hollywood. Ben was 20 years old when he started hanging out with Hollywood and his crew. So how did Ben come to owe Hollywood money? Here's the story. Ben had a friend that lived in San Diego. Now, this friend owed Hollywood $2,000. Hollywood tells Ben they're going to go to San Diego. They're going to, you know, hit up this friend, make him give them the $2,000. And by make him, I mean they're bringing duct tape, a bat, and a duffel bag in the back of Hollywood's car. And Ben drove to San Diego with Hollywood to collect this money. So this acquaintance of Ben, he doesn't have the money. He doesn't have $2,000. So he tells Hollywood and Ben, listen, I got this lead on some ecstasy pills. I can get you some pills that you can sell and you can make even more money than the $2,000 I owe you. How about we do that? So in, you know, wanting his acquaintance to be safe from harm from Hollywood and his gang, Ben decides to take on his acquaintance's debt and says, listen, Hollywood, we'll take these ecstasy pills, we'll sell them, I'll take his debt, you can take his part of the money, but then we'll split the rest of the money. Only thing is that these ecstasy pills didn't work. And don't ask me, I don't know how they didn't work, why they didn't work, I don't know a damn thing about ecstasy. I do know that these two ended up selling about $800 of these pills before they were being told, don't sell these anymore, they're a sham. So at this point, that means that Ben now has a debt of $1,200 to Hollywood. But these two have been friends for about a year, and Hollywood just kind of forgets about the debt. They just keep hanging out, and this money that is owed is not that big of a deal to Hollywood. But that is until the whole situation escalates one night. So at this point, Ben is engaged. He has a fiance, and she's a waitress. And she works at this local brewery. And one night, Hollywood and his girlfriend, Michelle Lasher, they come into this brewery and they eat dinner and they rack up a bill of about $50. And when Ben's fiance gives them the receipt, Hollywood writes on the receipt, take this out of Ben's debt, and then leaves. And then Ben, after hearing his fiance cry about this and say, what the hell? These two came into my restaurant and stiffed me. He says, I was really mad because I thought that Hollywood and I were friends. So this is when the tension gets way worse than anyone could imagine between Hollywood and Ben. I mean, you have to stop and think about the fact that this all ends in the most horrific, tragic way because of $1,200. So Hollywood is now threatening Ben, but through other people. So a lot of people say that Hollywood was so scared of Ben that he would never threaten him to his face. He was just telling other people to tell him that he's going to get him. So Ben loses his damn mind. The feud escalates and Ben calls Hollywood's phone, leaves a message saying, you're a little fucking punk and you're not getting a dime from me. The next time we see each other, we're going to handle business. And then Ben makes this even worse by calling Hollywood's insurance company because Hollywood was involved in insurance fraud, claiming that his car was stolen, but he was really chopping. Is that how you say it? You chopped a car and then you sell the parts. He was really doing that and hoping to say it was stolen and then he would collect $35,000 from insurance. But Ben called the insurance company and told them what was up. So now Jesse Hollywood is out of $35,000 and he tells everyone. Hollywood is just vowing to everyone that he sees, we will make Ben pay. Just after 1 p.m. on August 6th, 2000, Nick Markowitz left his house, snuck out of his house to avoid arguing with his parents, Jeff and Susan. As he was walking down the street, Jesse James Hollywood and his two friends, Jesse Ruge and William Skidmore, were driving along down the road in their van, and they saw Nick walking down the street, and it is then that they decided, you know what, let's kidnap Ben's younger brother and hold him for ransom. Okay, so they pull over the van, and they get out, and they just grab Nicholas, they drag him inside of the van, and a neighbor actually witnessed this, and this would be one of the first, one of the many, and I'm talking up to 30 different witnesses that saw Nick with Hollywood, with Ruge, with Skidmore. People saw Nick, adults, kids, other teenagers. Everybody knew that Nick was with these people. So this neighbor witnesses this incident. They call 911. They get the license plate, but police couldn't find the van. I mean, this witness was like, yo, I just saw a teenage boy get abducted and forced into a van. And the police were like, meh, we can't find it. So they have Nick inside of this van. They have him bound with duct tape, and they took his pager, his wallet. Nick has no idea what's going on. He knows that his brother, Ben, probably has something to do with this, but Nick has absolutely nothing to do with this. So this wasn't very planned out. This was spontaneous, spur of the moment, thinking these guys are the big gangsters that they think they are. They don't know what to do with Nick, where to take him. So they take him to Santa Barbara, and they're all drinking and doing drugs, so they let 15-year-old Nick drink and do drugs. Hollywood has Jesse Ruge handle Nick. He wants him to stay with Nick. So Jesse's actually taking Nick back to his house where he lives with his dad. His dad saw Nick. He even made a comment about the fact that Jesse's hanging out with this boy that looks like a child. Like, how old is this kid? But he did nothing. And Nick's getting along with Jesse. There comes a point where Jesse even tells him, you know what, just leave. I'll just tell them you got away, just leave. But Nick doesn't leave. Nick is the type of person that he thought if he did leave, he's just going to make this worse on Jesse. He's going to make it worse for Ben. And he was getting along with these guys. They weren't being mean to him. They were treating him like he was a friend and that they were just holding him until his brother paid up. And he knew his brother would pay up. I mean, they keep telling Nick he's going to go home. Then to have Hollywood just hand Nick off to Jesse Ruge. And Jesse Ruge's, he's got other plans. He's got other things going down that day. He invites his friends over to his house, to the pool, to have fun, to have a little party. He invites his friends, Graham Presley, Natasha Adams-Young, and Kelly Carpenter over to party. Now, these three also have absolutely nothing to do with this. They do not know what is going on. They're just going over to their friend Jesse's house to hang out, smoke some weed, you know, get high, get drunk, go swimming. Then they meet Nick. So as I was saying, many witnesses met Nick. Many witnesses saw Nick with Jesse Ruge, with Hollywood, but nobody knew what was going on. Nobody reported anything because nobody knew that Nick was kidnapped, that Nick was being held for ransom. And that is until they did know, because Graham Presley and Natasha and Kelly soon find out that Nick was kidnapped, and they start referring to him as Stolen Boy. But these three teenagers, they also don't realize the ramifications about what is going on. They don't understand that this is serious, and they're being told, okay, listen, yeah, we kidnapped him, but we're giving him back. We're just holding him for a little bit, so why not let him party? Why not let him have some fun? And that's what they do. For the next 2 days, they just sort of party. According to an All That's Interesting article, the former Santa Barbara County Chief Deputy Sheriff Bruce Coral, he said that Nick didn't think he was in any danger. Nick even reportedly told his captors, "This will be a story I can tell my grandchildren," and they would all joke about this. And Nick might be seemingly having a good time, like this is his first time away from home, being able to do all the bad things he's always getting in trouble for, but the first 36 hours he was missing, they weren't as fun for Nick's parents. They were just frantically trying to reach out to any of Nick's friends, to any of Nick's friends' parents, trying to figure out what the hell happened, where the hell did he go? But then they finally get in touch with their son, Ben, and he says he hasn't heard from Nick either. This is when they call the police. While Nick is being held captive, he becomes really close to Graham Presley. These two are hanging out a lot. They're closer in age than anyone else. Graham is 17. There comes a point at one of the house parties where Graham says, "Why don't you just run for it? Why don't you get out of here? I won't tell anybody." And Graham says that Nick replied, "It was okay. It's okay if he stays because he's doing this for his brother. And as long as his brother was okay, then Nick was okay." And Nick felt safe because even Jesse Ruge is telling him, "I'm going to take you home. Don't you worry. I'll put you on a Greyhound and I'm going to get you home." So while Hollywood's crew is partying it up, they got this kid held for ransom. They're all just having the time of their lives. They have no idea that Hollywood is talking to his dad, and Hollywood has called his family lawyer. He calls his family lawyer and says, "Hey, so just a question for you. Let's say someone I know kidnapped a kid, an underage kid, and held him for ransom." And the lawyer is like, "Dude, that is life in prison." And Hollywood starts losing his mind. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know any way out of this now because at this point, he's going to go to prison. So he's trying to come up with a different way to get out of this. First thing he does is he asks Jesse Ruge to take him out, to kill Nick. Jesse's like, "Hell no." First of all, Jesse's the one that's been hanging out with this kid for almost 3 days now. He's grown really close to Nick and he's like, "Hollywood, you're out of your damn mind. We don't need to do this." So who do you think Hollywood calls? Yeah, the chump, Ryan Hoyt. He calls him and he says, "We got a little situation and you're going to take care of it for me. And that's how you're going to clear your debt." Jesse James Hollywood offered his friend Ryan Hoyt a clean slate, no more debt, and an additional $400 payment if he killed 15-year-old Nick Markowitz in the early hours of August 9th, 2000. Hollywood gives his friend a semi-automatic handgun, and he directs him to kill Nicholas. He also tells him that this murder should be committed on the Lizard's Mouth Trail in the Santa Ynez Mountains. So Jesse Ruge, he liked to stay at this hotel called the Lemon Tree Inn. So he would stay there, have some parties, and this night they're having a party. On August 9th, 2000, it is Jesse Ruge, Nicholas Markowitz, and Graham Presley. They're all hanging out alone. And Ryan Hoyt enters the hotel room with his gun. He gets Graham Presley to take a ride with him. He takes Graham Presley up to Lizard's Mouth, and this is where he makes Graham dig a grave. Graham is just 17 years old. He's been drinking all day. He's high on whatever. Now, Ryan has been this type of guy that is just pushed down all the time. Everyone in his little gang just makes fun of him, treats him like shit. And now he's the older guy and he's got a younger guy and he's telling him what to do. You can only imagine how scared Graham was digging this grave with a man, a 20-year-old man standing next to him holding a gun. Graham digs that shallow grave, gets back in the car with Ryan Hoyt. They drive back to the Lemon Tree Inn and they pick up Jesse Ruge and Nick. And they tell Nick that they are now driving him home. So all four of them get into the vehicle and they start to drive, but they're not driving Nick home. They're driving Nick back up to the Lizard's Mouth Trail near Santa Barbara. It is in the early morning hours of August 9th, 2000, and they are driving this 15-year-old boy to a shallow grave. And they walk Nick up to this shallow grave. And this entire time, Nick is terrified. He is pleading with them. He's starting to understand what is going on. They get him to this shallow grave. They wrap his hands in duct tape. And it is said that they wrapped his hands so much that you couldn't even see his fingers. Like, his hands were completely wrapped. They wrap his mouth. And then Ryan Hoyt strikes Nick on the back of the head with a shovel. Nick falls into that shallow grave, and he shoots Nick 13 times with 9 of those bullets hitting Nick. And those pieces of shit, they cover that grave, that shallow grave, with dirt, with branches, and then they drive away. They go home. Nick thought that he was on his way home to see his mom, and Nick's body was not found for 3 more days by some hikers. Nick's picture is all over the paper. Nick's parents have been looking for him. Everyone in the community knows they're looking for this 15-year-old. So it did not take long for police to round up Jesse Ruge, William Skidmore, Ryan Hoyt, Graham Presley. But where's Jesse James Hollywood? Because Jesse James Hollywood, the ringmaster of this whole thing, he took off. He fled. And while Hollywood's minions were having their day in court, nobody knew where Hollywood was. But they were still trying to prosecute these boys. And Graham Presley, age 17, he was tried twice. And in July 2002, he was acquitted of kidnapping, but the jury was hung on the murder charge. And then again in October 2002, retried on the murder charge and was convicted of second-degree murder. Graham Presley, 17, just met these kids. He was forced to dig a shallow grave. Graham was incarcerated at a California Youth Authority facility until he was 25 years old, and he was released in 2007. Then we have William Skidmore. He was 20 years old at the time of Nick's murder. He was charged with kidnapping and robbery. In September of 2002, he was sentenced to 9 years in a state prison, and this was as a part of a plea bargain. He was released in April 2009. Jesse Taylor Ruge, he was 20 years old at the time of the murder. He was charged with aiding in the kidnap and the murder of Nicholas Markowitz, and he was convicted in 2002 of aggravated kidnapping for ransom or extortion with special circumstances, but he was acquitted on the murder charge. Jesse Ruge was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 7 years, and in 2006, he was denied parole. But after serving 11 years in prison, he was granted parole and released on October 24th, 2013. And then we have our little chump, Ryan Hoyt, 20 years old. He was charged with first-degree murder, and he was convicted on November 21st, 2001, and he was sentenced to death. You know, I'm going to say it should be the kind of death where you take him up to a little trail, you dig a little grave, you hit him on the back of the head with a shovel, then you shoot him 13 times. But his death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment in 2024. The Markowitz family won an $11.2 million lawsuit in 2003, and this lawsuit was against not only the kidnappers and the murderers, but also the owners of the homes, the several homes, where Nick was held against his will. So, of course, Jesse James Hollywood, he left his minions high and dry. He just let them take the blame, and he took off, and he was a fugitive for almost 6 years. His case was even featured on Unsolved Mysteries. This dude, he just takes off. Where did he go? Well, he was arrested in Rio de Janeiro in 2005, and police found him under the alias of Michael Costa Giroux. And the way that they found him was they tapped his father's phone. They traced his father's phone calls. Hollywood chose Brazil because he liked the movie Blame It on Rio. So while in Brazil, Hollywood meets this woman. Her name is Marcia Reese, and she is an older woman. He thinks that she is his ticket to freedom, and that is because he was under the assumption that if he got a woman pregnant, if he was a father-to-be, that he wasn't allowed to be extradited back to the United States. And he did tell this Marsha woman that he was in a lot of trouble in the U.S. and he was kind of hiding out in Brazil, but she really didn't know the extent to what kind of trouble he was in. Neighbors also said that they didn't really like him, that he was a little weird, he was a little rude, he was always fighting with Marsha. They could hear those two arguing all of the time. And just everyone that they lived close to, anyone that they were friends with, just felt like there was something a little off about this guy. So while police are transporting Hollywood back home to the U.S., they can't have handcuffs on him on the plane, so they tied his wrist with rope. And every time he had to get up to use the bathroom, they would use nail clippers to cut the ropes off slowly, let him go to the bathroom, and then tie him back up. And the only thing that Hollywood said the entire time that he was in custody, he said, "My father's going to be really mad at you guys, that you got me this way, that you're doing this to me." But unbeknownst to Hollywood, on the very same day that he was being transported back to the U.S., his 50-year-old father, Jack Hollywood, was also being arrested. And this was for manufacturing the date rape drug, GHB. And the police did this on purpose. They made a point to say, yeah, we were going to get them both on the same day. So while police are transporting Jesse James Hollywood to the jail to await sentencing, he was an asshole. He was saying, "This is all bullshit." He was bragging about how he evaded the law for 6 years. He was saying that the only reason that he is being arrested is because his name is Jesse James Hollywood. He never showed 1 ounce of remorse or regret. In fact, while this dude is in jail awaiting trial, he's signing his name Alpha Dog. Nope, he's not Hollywood anymore. He's Alpha Dog. And he's telling everybody in that jail that he's going to go on an Alpha Dog world tour. And on the first day of his defense, he claims he had nothing to do with this. He had nothing at all to do with this. Ryan Hoyt did it. Ryan Hoyt got the gun. He's innocent. He even claims that when Ryan told him about what happened, Ryan came up to him at a birthday party and said, "Hey, I killed Nick Markowitz." Hollywood said he got really mad. He was like, "Why would you do that?" The prosecution called witnesses such as Jeff Markowitz, Nick's dad, Pauline Mahoney, who was a woman that was driving down the road with her sons in the car when she saw a group of men attack Nick and throw him into the van. And then they also had Brian Affonti. He was a friend of Hollywood's who was picked up after the kidnapping. And this witness and friend of Hollywood, Brian Affonti, he also testified to the fact that the gun that Ryan Hoyt used actually belonged to Hollywood. The jury deliberated for 3 days, and in 2009, Jesse James Hollywood was convicted of kidnapping and first-degree murder. They found him to have ordered the murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Hollywood's defense, they claimed that Hollywood had nothing to do with this. He was not guilty because of the fact that Nick could have left at any time. And Hollywood wasn't even there when it happened. He left, and that is where Hollywood's responsibility ends, because he didn't even see Nick anymore after he left. And of course, Jesse James Hollywood had women writing to him while he was in prison, and one of those women was named Melinda Enos. She decided to marry Jesse James Hollywood on January 19th, 2014, and they had their ceremony in the prison's visitor's room. And as of today, with the release of Jesse Ruge in October 2013, the only two that remain in prison are Jesse James Hollywood and Ryan Hoyt. When Susan Markowitz was pregnant with her son Nick, she bought a journal and she wrote her baby boy some letters. And her husband Jeff also wrote some letters. And I'm going to end this episode with the letters that Jeff and Susan wrote to their baby boy, Nick Markowitz. This is an excerpt from the book My Stolen Son by Susan Markowitz. I kept a journal with details about every little movement I felt. He had hiccups for the first time on June 21st. He kicked me in the ribs for the first time on June 25th. I wrote little love notes to my baby telling him how I couldn't wait to meet him. Jeff got in on the action too. I just got home from the gym. Your mom is writing thank you notes for your baby shower. First, I just want you to know what a wonderful mommy you are going to have. She is very pretty, warm, and thoughtful. The two of you growing together for 9 months has made her the happiest woman in the world. I will love you and care for you forever. Love, Daddy. Susan then writes, labor was induced, and after 19 and a half hours of back labor, and yes, I would do it again, Nicholas Samuel Markowitz was born, just an ounce shy of 9 pounds, on September 19th, 1984, and I wrote this to him in his baby book. Our world is blessed and honored upon your arrival. We have waited for such a long time to see your beautiful face. You have fulfilled my life, and I knew you would, but it is better than I ever imagined. I feel so complete, so happy. I love you very much. Love, your mom, Susan. Stay safe and stay paranoid.
Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hello, America. It's your new favourite podcast here.
Yes, it's James and Andy, two fourths of the British podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do facts. We do weird facts, fun facts, facts you've never heard before. James, give us a fact.
Did you know you may be able to cure chronically blocked noses with a snot transplant?
Lovely, lovely facts.
If you want to hear us, go to wherever you get your podcasts and search for No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We'll see you there.